Hey everybody, I'm Jay Worthy and this is the podcast for anyone trying to inject some adventure, purpose and balance into their lives. 28 Summers is all about living life adventurously, seizing the moment and optimizing your life. Now my guest today is Jenny Wordsworth. Jenny is a lawyer by day and an ultra endurance athlete by night. She is a North Face athlete who completed an unassisted 715-mile solo ski across the Antarctic to the South Pole, pulling an 80-kilo sledge whilst battling a crippling case of polar thigh. She talks about that epic challenge, handling failure, setting boundaries at work, and so much more. She even shares the image of her leg injuries, which, I should say, are not for the faint-hearted. I absolutely love chatting to Jenny, and I really hope you enjoy the chat as much as I did. Jenny, welcome to the 28 Summers podcast. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Oh, thank you for having me on, Jay.
Yeah, I'm really, really excited. And there's so much I want to talk about with you. So I'm going to dive right in. And the first thing that I wanted to start with, I do like always talking to my guests about their upbringing, their childhood. And I was particularly keen to do that with you because I know you grew up in Borneo. And so that Borneo is like really high. In fact, it's top of my bucket list. It's somewhere I've dreamt of going for years. So I just had to ask you about growing up in Borneo.
Yeah, I moved there at the age of four until I think I was about 11 or 12. It was incredible. Very free, mostly just running around a rainforest, picking up snakes and bugs that I probably shouldn't be touching. I mean, I was quite young, so mostly it was about school things I remember. Everything's very open plan, very outdoorsy. It's like so different to the UK. I spent a lot of time in the orangutan sanctuary down the road. I volunteered there as a kid. A lot of stuff at the seaside. Like, I just, it was a very, very happy time. I'm very grateful I had that upbringing. But actually, most of my memories from being there are being very aware of poverty. So, like, the local kids, not like we were all, so my parents worked in the oil industry, and that's why we were there. So we kind of lived on a different camp. But the kind of local Indonesian kids, and I was fluent in Indonesian for a little while. Now all I can remember is, can I please have my bottle of milk? That's all I can say. Sayu mayo susu, that's all I can remember and counting. But the kids had nothing, but they made such better toys than the plastic, you know, I had in my bedroom. So I was really drawn to hang out with them. But it did make me very, very aware of poverty for maybe a younger age than I should have been. But in terms of like adventure, it was amazing. And also it was very easy to travel to other places as a family. You know, you could really easily get to Australia, whereas, you know, if you were a family in the UK, you can't visit Australia that easily and it's super expensive. So yeah, really fortunate. And it a lot. I just had a lot of fun. That's all I really remember.
So you have really fond memories of that time. Were you 11 when you moved back to the UK?
Yeah,
so
11 were you, or 12, yeah.
11 or 12, yeah. So were you a reluctant traveller? Did you want to stay or were you happy to be coming back?
My memory of being told we were moving to the UK was my parents sitting us down and saying, so in the UK, school finishes at 3:15. And my brothers and I being like, what? Like, we'd heard rumours that this was the case, but didn't think it could be true because it was so hot in Borneo that I think you started school much early, but you were done by lunchtime and you had lunch at home. So first of all, I was like, this sounds like hell. Like, why would anyone want to go to school until 3:15? That's going to impact on my rainforest time in a big way. I honestly wasn't that excited. But when we got to the UK, first week of school, I was pretty badly bullied for a little while. Because I remember my first week, this boy tapped me on the shoulder and with a very like thick Scottish accent and said to me, I heard that you're black. And I was like, excuse me? Now, I'm white. I've got blonde hair, blue eyes. And sure, I had a dark tan, but I couldn't understand how anyone could think I was black.
So was that just because of where you'd been?
Where I'd come from. Yeah. Yeah. It was like, this girl's moved here from the jungle. She's black. And I just remember being very aware that it was a negative And I didn't understand that because I'd mixed with all kinds of kids in Borneo and didn't really know there was a distinction to be made. And I think it broke my parents' heart because they said that week they had to, when I got home, they had to explain to me what racism was. And I had no idea. And after that, I remember thinking, wow, I just don't like the UK. They don't like people of their different skin color and I can't figure out why. And school doesn't finish until 3:15. I just wasn't taken with it. And then I remember as well in Borneo, there was no Top of the Pops, no music charts. And so at that age, it was like Take That or Boyzone. Which band do you like? I'd never heard of them. So I got picked on for that. I also had no concept of, you know, it's like when you're a teenager, like you care about branded clothing, like what are you wearing to school, that kind of thing. I had no idea. There was none of that in Borneo because the only clothes were the ones available in the one shop.
Right.
And I thought people were weird for that as well. And my parents tell me now that they fought really hard to keep me that way, to not care about what you were wearing and boys on a Take That, but it's impossible when you're a teenage girl.
Yeah, sure.
I just wanted to fit in. I didn't care. I was like, just tell me about the bands, I'll pick one. I remember my mum coming home with a copy of Smash Hits and she was like, now let's read this together and you'll learn who the bands are. I loved the snow. I remember thinking, oh, I haven't seen much snow before, this is fun, in Northern Scotland, but I was not totally taken. I didn't quite understand the place.
Yeah, it sounds like a pretty hard landing. But did you, once you kind of settled in, did you start to enjoy the outdoors and what Scotland had to offer?
Yeah, we were really lucky that it was so easy to kind of get out and do things. I love Scotland so much for that, especially like their wild camping laws and everything you can take advantage of up there. So yeah, I was very happy after kind of 6 months a year. I just thought the UK was odd.
Yeah, for sure. Like I said, it's a really hard landing and kind of baffling that you would have been greeted that way. But and also, it, like you say, it's heartbreaking as well, isn't it? That a kind of an innocent 11-year-old has to find out about things that way. But but did you, once you settled, what was life like once you settled into a routine and rhythm in Scotland? I think you started to get into sport. Is that right?
Yeah, I'd always done a lot of sport, and I started swimming. I was on the national squad for Scotland, so swimming like 6 days a week. And then I played cricket for Scotland for a very short amount of time, and I think I won Best Female Cricket Player of the Year, but there was only about three of us in Scotland, so that doesn't mean much. I just, like, in my family, it was like, you're signing up to all the sports. I think it was a strategy to just keep you so busy through teenagehood that you couldn't get up to no good. I had a great time. There was just so much to do locally. And I was very happy in Scotland.
Nice. And then you went to, so later on you went to University of Edinburgh and studied law. What was the thinking there? Was that your passion? You kind of an early passion and decided that was something you wanted to do?
Yeah, I knew I was going to be a lawyer from about the age of six, apparently.
Really?
I met one of my dad's friends was like an IP lawyer for Coca-Cola. And for some reason I thought that was really cool, which is a bit sad that I can't. Yeah, I've always known. And it's quite handy to know what you want to do, because I know not many people do, they're still figuring out, but I was very clear I'm going to be a lawyer, and I want to study at Edinburgh. It was a fantastic law school. And off I went. Yeah.
And during your time at university, did you start to become more and more adventurous, start to have more kind of extreme adventures? Is that where it all started?
Not really at uni. Like, okay. Uni was just kind of, well, for me, it was half marathons. Marathons kind of in the mountains in Scotland, so they were quite fun. But I think uni was more time of like, wait a minute, I don't have to swim 6 days a week, I can just drink beer and this is great fun. I think I'll just do that for a while. I think that's not fun permanently. And I think the sport, like, you know, the upbringing I'd had always been sports, that kind of came back in a big way a couple of years into uni. But in terms of doing like the more, I mean, I think I climbed Kilimanjaro at uni. I think that was then. Doing kind of the bigger ticket stuff was definitely nearer kind of graduation time, and then working as a junior lawyer. rather than time at uni, I was, having too much fun.
And it sounds about normal for everybody at university and fresh out. What at what stage did kind of the idea of becoming a professional athlete alongside being a lawyer, when did that start to come up?
Yeah, so it was never a plan. Kind of after uni, started doing more and more of these, I guess what they call extreme adventures, and then was doing well in them, not like outstanding. I don't think you need to be winning races for this to happen, but I was like on the podium. I was just doing well, and a clothing company called X Bionic approached me to said, "Have you ever thought about going pro?" And it was like, oh, and I actually think I'd been a lawyer maybe 4 or 5 years at this point, so 2 years of training, still quite a baby lawyer. And but I was like, yeah, I mean, why not? It was a 2-year contract. They moved me to the US, and I had an absolute blast. A lot of people kind of asked, like, oh, your salary must have gone to nothing, and it did. But I couldn't have cared less. I felt like I had the same amount of money. And you have to remember as well, all your travel, race entry fees, they're all covered. The only thing I would say, and people think it's amazing to go pro. I didn't totally love it because I'd gone from being able to do any race I wanted. And for me, I would often pick races based on their location. So it would be like, Iran, I'd never go there otherwise, more than likely. But there's a 6-day race through the desert there. Yeah, why not? What a great way of seeing Iran. And that's how I picked my races, really. Where were they? And all of a sudden, it was like, well, we don't really want you to do 6 races a year, but we want you to do like 2 or 3 and, like, you know, do really well in them. So that was a bit less fun. And then the other thing I found really odd was the coaches would set my training schedule. And say on like a rest day, it might be like an hour's gentle jog in the morning and then nothing for the rest of the day. And that was so bizarre to me. And I felt like I wasn't really a proper adult or like a functioning member of society. It felt weird not having what I'd call like a proper job. And then when you kind of see friends in the evening or, you know, doing something, what have you been up to today? And you're like, well, today was a rest day, so not very much. And actually what I started... the bad habits I got into were, to me, I always felt like, this is when I was much younger, I'm a little bit more grown up now, but it was, the more I train, the better I'll do. That was my mentality as an athlete. And I have had to work so hard at that. And it's only thanks to the amazing coaching team I've got, because they know what I'm like, that they kind of got me to stop being like that. Because it's not a case of the more you train, the better you do. It's the more you train, the more injured you're going to get. And I was injured a lot in those 2 years. Because to me, I was like, I need to fill this time. I can't just do nothing, you know, once I've done the session. And I was happier when I also missed being a lawyer, which no one believes. But once I went back to it, I'm much happier balancing both. And I think it's because you can't overtrain because you've got work in between.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I'd love to come back to that and hear how you kind of fit it in around work, because that can't be easy. But it's a really interesting perspective. I don't think I've ever really heard anybody talk about professional sport in that way. But when you put that frame on it, it makes total sense. Like you're relinquishing quite a lot of control, aren't you?
Yeah, you are. And, you know, oh, I've heard about this amazing race in China I want to do. And I was like, well, no, we were thinking you'd do this one. And you're like, oh, okay. Yeah, okay, that's fine. And then is it fine? Like, why did I get into this in the first place? It's not because I particularly care about winning races. They're my kind of fun, my type 3, type 4 fun.
Yeah, exactly. It's a little bit like, you hear singers sometimes talk about this when they sign to a record label and like all the things that got them into it that they were really passionate about. And then the record label wants them to go in a certain direction, make them sing certain songs, and it kind of changes the enjoyment factor for them.
Yeah, I bet it does. Yeah, absolutely.
So things were going pretty well, though. I mean, notwithstanding the fact that you maybe lost a little bit of control, but you were able to kind of do this professional, athlete role, and you were seeing the world, perhaps not always the places you wanted to, but things were going pretty well. And then your life took a bit of a turn, didn't it? Because you got unwell, pretty seriously unwell.
Yeah, but getting unwell was actually before I went pro.
Oh, was it?
Maybe only... Oh, I can't remember how many years, maybe 2 or 3 years before, two years before maybe. They found quite a large growth in my abdomen, and they couldn't biopsy it because of the size, so we weren't sure what it was. I had 3 months of treatment to shrink it, which was unpleasant, and then an operation to have it removed. And it was fine. It was a completely benign, random growth. But it feels like so long ago now. But yeah, to me, I honestly acted like it was nothing. That's kind of the way I was, probably still am. Everything's going to be fine. Of course it will be. I'm now being treated. So whatever it is, you know, tackle it head on. And there's no family history of anything like that. So it sounds a bit naive, but it wasn't a big deal to me. Until actually the only really fearful time where I remember being like, this is actually pretty terrifying, was waiting for the results to come back on the sample after the surgery. And I remember having a moment of being like, hold on, what if what if this is really bad news? And it's like, no, it won't be, it's fine. I remember the doctor at the time after the first two meetings with him, wouldn't let me come alone anymore. I had to come with a friend or family member because he said he felt like I wasn't taking any of it in, or maybe taking it as seriously as I should be. that changed a lot of things for me. Until then, I'd been working as a junior lawyer in the city and if I got home at 11 p.m., I thought that was good. You'd be encouraged to work the weekends, and it was sort of very much looked down upon if you didn't, because you were doing something with your free time. How dare you? And after that, I mean, I was off maybe work for about 3-4 months, and after that I thought, I think the balance, I somehow got a bit lost along the way here. I definitely loved working in the law firm and you know, being a part of that, but it was like, I'm not sure it's worth the cost of what I'm losing, because I'm not doing any kind of fun stuff anymore.
Right.
Yeah.
It's I'm sorry, I didn't realize that was before you turned pro.
No, no.
That kind of period of being unwell and having to deal with that, do you think that was part of the impetus for you to say yes then to turning pro, to do something different and kind of break free from those crazy hours?
I think my personality, I would have said yes anyway, because you just don't turn opportunities like that down. I've got years ahead of making money and working as a lawyer. That's not a big deal. That qualification's not going anywhere. Having that injury, the tumor, made me more sort of, I'm not going to say yes to working the weekends, and I don't care if that looks bad or goes down on some report somewhere. I like to think it's a bit different now. And that's not as encouraged, but when I was there, it was very much like, oh, well, you know, that's being noted. And I started getting back into triathlon in a big way again. And I remember one day my boss calling me in for a chat, and I was like, oh, God. And the chat was along the lines of, we've noticed that you are less available at weekends now. You're going off to do these like races and things, and you're on the fast track here in the firm, you're doing really well, and I think I'd like you to go away and have a think about what's more important. And I remember she had her both hands up, kind of weighing the two options, going to do your triathlon, which she didn't like obviously, yeah. or you know, fast tracking here. And I was like, when I got home, I was like, oh, you've made this so easy for me now. Like, I know exactly what's more important to me. Like, almost like I was grateful actually for this kind of little dressing down. The following week I got a job as a lawyer, as in-house legal counsel. It wouldn't be the following week. A few weeks later it would have taken to go through interviews and like. And the hours there are known to be a bit more reasonable. And I resigned. And it was the best thing I ever did. Yeah, far more normal working hours. You kind of treated more like a normal employee and not, the being in hostel was a massive turning point. Absolutely. It was.
Yeah. And that whole kind of, culture that I think it still exists, unfortunately, in many organizations. You know, I spent 20 years in commercial organizations, and, you know, I see it a lot, and I got caught up in that. I got caught up in that whole kind of executive tide of, I have to keep up. I have to stay ahead. I have to do the extra hours, work hard. And you don't realize how much it's dragging you along until one day you suddenly realize that you've lost track of everything that was important to you.
So, totally
understand that. And it's difficult, isn't it? Because I think when you, I'd love to hear your point of view on this, because you've obviously then gone back and you're working as a lawyer and you're doing it differently. And I've done something quite similar. You know, I've gone back and I now have a busy day job, but I take a slightly different approach to it now. Well, not a slightly different, a very different approach to it now. And it's fine. That it's, you know, it's okay. It's okay just
nobody
to say,
died. Everything's fine.
Yeah. And nobody's emailing me. I mean, it's not quite like the firm that you were at, but nobody's emailing me saying, hey, why aren't you online on a Sunday afternoon? Like if I get my work done, I get my work done. And I think that's quite interesting, isn't it? Because sometimes I think we build it up in our mind that we have to keep up with everybody else.
Yeah. What I learned was like setting boundaries was everything. So Right. Now everyone knows Jen's not going to say yes to a 7 p.m. meeting. So Yeah. Don't even bother asking. And I find that if people don't set the boundaries, then that's when you kind of get more and more lost. But it takes a while to learn that lesson. You know, I was younger and it was just like, say yes to everything because surely I should. Whereas now, no, I'm not working. I don't work weekends ever. I certainly don't work late, especially not in lockdown. And it's fine. Like you say, nothing bad happened. I still have a job.
Yeah.
And I'm much happier. So yeah, that's the way it is.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think, well, life is about happiness, isn't it? It's about finding the right balance. And of course we've got to earn money and pay the bills, but also you've got to kind of follow your passions. I read somewhere that you, when you were, you know, kind of in your hospital bed and you were kind of dealing with the tumor, that at that moment you decided you were going to do the marathon disabler. Is that right? Have I got that right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I have no memory of doing this. I only know because my parents told me. But I used someone's iPad. It wasn't mine, to use the Wi-Fi in the hospital, and signed up to the marathon disab. And it was full. I didn't get a spot immediately. I was signed up to a waiting list or something, and then completely forgot about it. And then about 3 months later, it's like Sunday lunch, everyone's around the table, and I get an email on my phone, and it's like, congratulations, a spot's come up on the marathon disab waiting list, you've got until tomorrow or whatever to pay for it. And I was like, this is really weird spam. It looks like genuine. And then something in my head was just like, wait a minute. My dad was like, no, I kind of remember that you were like, I was on a lot of morphine,
right?
I don't know if I think I just watched, there was like a James Cracknell documentary, I think I'd been watching that in hospital, and something just happened with the morphine, and I was like, this is a great idea. But I think, I wonder if subconsciously I knew I was going to be fine. I honestly believed that. But I think I wanted something in the future. And then after that, I had about 6 months to get ready for it. Not very long. But yeah, I do remember being in the hospital, and I had like this little handout from the hospital, and it listed all the drugs that you personally were allowed for pain relief. And third on the list, it said in capital letters, PMA. And one day I was like, someone was saying to the nurse, I was like, I haven't had that drug before. And she burst out laughing. She's like, yes, you have. You have it in spades, my dear. And I was really worried. I was like, no, nurse, like, I genuinely have never had that drug. Like, check on my drug chart. I've never had it. I don't even know what it is. Like, I was worried someone thought I'd had it and I hadn't. She's laughing. And she's like, PMA is positive mental attitude. I was like, oh, God, okay, right, fine. Yeah, it's not a drug. Okay.
That's amazing.
Yeah, it's always stayed with me because I got really worried that I'd been administered something I wasn't supposed to have or something.
So how was the MDS? How did you find it as a challenge?
Oh my God, I loved it.
Did you?
I really, really loved it. It's a very expensive race to do, and it seems to be getting more expensive every year. I mean, there's other versions of the MDS you can now do that are much cheaper. But it still seems to be the iconic one that, especially a lot of people in the UK, most of the people doing the race are Brits. I absolutely love it. You mean you make friends for life in the tent? You're with like 6 or 7 other people in the tent. And one of the most memorable moments for me was like, there's a stage where you run through the night. You don't have to, but you can. And as you're coming over a huge sand dune, there was an MDS orchestra playing at like 3 in the morning. And that was just surreal. I do remember thinking in that race, so memory mind had done nothing like this before, never done a 6-day race. And you're also carrying everything on your back for that race. So kind of weight becomes a bit obsessive. What food are you going to take? You're going to take a stove, you're going to do this. And there's like forum after forum with hundreds of people weighing in with their opinion. And what I realized is I was taking quite a different approach to what the kind of the veterans would tell you for the race. And I think everything that I did was absolutely fine. Like I had no stove. I ate cold food. I didn't have any, like a lot of people want to take like little treats or whatever. I find that I'm not interested in that. Like I want the absolute bare minimum. And what I definitely learned was that I think a lot of us, when we come to something new, we kind of forget that our own experiences definitely bring something to the table. So sure, like listen to someone who's done it before. Don't be an arse. Yeah. But, don't just think I must follow blindly what other people tell me to do because they've done this before. There's always something in your background that'll kind of bring a unique slant on it. And I remember people telling me like before, yeah, you're mad. You should be doing it this way. You should be doing it that way. And I was like, well, you know, nothing bad's going to happen if I've really gone wrong. I did well in the Marathon de Sable. I just had so much fun. I love being in the heat. I have no idea that's to do with Borneo or what. It's such a good race. Such a good race.
Have you ever thought about doing it again or was once enough?
No, I'd happily do it again. The reason I wouldn't do it again is I could probably do 4 races for the cost of 1 Marathon de Sable.
Yeah, it's expensive.
Yeah, and I just don't think it's kind of worth it. And also, now when there's time to go and do something like that, I want to go to a different country. Yeah. And I've raced a lot in Morocco. Yeah, I know it really well.
And there are quite a few multi-stage races like that now that are kind of crafted in the mold of MDS, aren't there? Like the Jungle Marathon and, you know, Gobi Crossing and Namibia, and there's loads now. So there's quite a lot to choose from, isn't there?
Absolutely, yeah, yeah.
So let's talk about one that's like that. Essentially, you did in February 2016, you took part in the Ice Ultra, which was 230 kilometers running through Arctic Sweden, right?
Yeah.
So how did that come about, and how was it?
I don't know why I signed up to that, because I hated, at the time, I couldn't stand the cold. I did it with my best friend, Hazel. I think we just thought it'd be a laugh. I think she preferred the cold. Maybe that's why. And that was like a compromise, because I'd always rather be in the desert and she doesn't like the heat. But I remember thinking, oh, I don't know about this. I think I thought it would be stunning, so beautiful. And it really was such an incredible race. But everything I'd done before, like I've said, I'd been in the heat. So I'd done a race in Iran where it was like 66 degrees Celsius. Across the Gobi, all these places, and I just was very happy in the warmth. And then suddenly it was like, oh, I'm going to get cold now. And actually, it was just a case, really straightforward, of learning about correct layering. Yeah. Also, very quick transitions. So, like, you know, at a water stop or whatever, you can't just hang out like you would in the heat and have a quick chat with someone. It was like, I've earned this body heat. And the pain for me would be like going off again and having to warm up again. You're kind of doing the helicoptering with the hands to get the blood flow back in. So it was like this, you've got to be really kind of fast and get moving. And then just really daft things like, yeah, learning about layering, but also mittens, much warmer than kind of finger gloves. Just these lessons that I didn't really know about the cold and the cold environment. But actually getting back from that, I realized, wait a minute, I had completely written off doing anything in the cold because I don't like it.
Yeah.
Like, why did you do that? Because actually it was absolutely fine. And then, wait a minute, am I applying that mentality to other things? Because I really shouldn't be. Mm. But I did. I fell through a frozen lake on that race.
Did you?
Yeah. Wow. I was up front and they had medics on. It was quite a big lake. They had medics on both sides because they thought it might go. And it did when Bigfoot came running across it here. I got very mild hypothermia. Which was on film, and it was actually fascinating to watch because my memory, if you'd asked me what it was like to be hypothermic, But it was fine. I just, you know, I came out, all my clothes were kind of frozen. They got that off me, put some fresh clothes on, and got me in the warmth in this kind of a little tent they had on the side of the lake. And yeah, my memory was I just got changed, ate some food and cracked on. And everyone was like, that's not what happened. And you watch the video, I was talking absolute nonsense. And I was like basically trying to strip off, which I now know is a common thing when you're hypothermic.
Is that right?
Yeah, I was like, I don't want a jacket on, take it off me. And then also in the video, I was very, very worried because I think they had to put me on a snowmobile to take me to the tent. It was a little tiny amount of distance away, but they didn't want me to walk. And I apparently made them like put rocks on the floor because like, I don't want to be disqualified if you drive me to the tent for treatment because I'm coming back. So we need to know exactly where you dropped me off. So I made them, I wouldn't get any help from them until they marked the ground where they exactly they were taking me away from so I could go back and carry on the race. And they just thought I was nuts. But yeah, I do remember hearing them, the medics taking bets that I wouldn't be able to carry on with the race. And I remember thinking, what? No, of course I am. Of course I'm carrying on with the race. And I had a little bit of, I had frostnip on the back of my ankles. I remember that hurt. But yeah, an hour later I was out the door and said like, everyone watch, I'm back at the stones. I'm starting again.
That's amazing. I didn't realize that. And what about, so what about Antarctica? Where did the idea, did the idea happen during the Arctic race or was it before or after that?
No, it was definitely after. Antarctica came about because I've always wanted to go there. I've always thought I would go there, but I had no idea doing what or how. Again, it was like when I talk about picking things to do based on the country. Always wanted to go to Antarctica. And it actually started out as a plan to go with some friends and do a mountaineering expedition. So climb Mount Vinson. It's one of the seven summits in Antarctica. And then I wanted to do a new route from the kind of the base of Mount Vinson, maybe to the pole, maybe to the coast. Wasn't really sure yet. Just kind of investigating what was possible. And then I got a... basically, to go anywhere new in Antarctica, you need satellite footage of that area. You need to know where the major crevasse fields are so you can plan a route through. And the route from Vincent to the pole was heavily crevassed in lots of places. And I was told to get the satellite data I would need. It came from NASA, them just like turning their satellite just a tiny bit, and it was going to be about 500,000. I remember getting that email and being like, and I felt so naive. Like, I just thought, I'm looking at the map of Antarctica and I'll go from here to here and it'll be really... So that was, honestly, that was out the window within 24 hours. And I don't know what happened, but the next morning I remember at breakfast being like, I know what I'm going to do now. I'm gonna go for the women's record and I'm going to ski solo from the coastline of Antarctica to the South Pole. And the women's record is 38 days. And you're doing that solo, unsupported, unassisted. I think I told my family on Boxing Day, no one batted an eyelid. And it's like, okay, Jen. And then, I think it was about 2 years after that, that I actually was in Antarctica at the start line and the coastline, ready to go. Yeah.
And that's about a little over 700 miles. So it's, I mean, this is an epic distance. I love the fact your family didn't even bat an eyelid. That kind of speaks to their knowledge of you and the things that you sign up for. But presumably there was a couple of years in there of hard training and fundraising, I guess, to pull everything together that you needed.
Yeah, the fundraising is a huge element of it. It's very, very expensive to go to Antarctica. And also, I still wanted to climb that mountain I mentioned. I wanted to go and climb Mount Vinson while I was there because I was fully aware I would never be going back. Because it's so expensive. In the end, I was back, but I'll get on to that in a minute. It was a long time fundraising. I got some incredible sponsors in the end. So DHL, Atkins, an American protein bar company who I knew from when I was pro out there. They completely had my back. And they loved it. And initially DHL had this idea that I might race a package to the South Pole. But I'm glad that was dropped because it's a bit cheesy. It was a bit Top Gear. Actually, they did in the end send a package to the Paul that I opened when I got there, with a few goodies in it, which was kind of them. But it was, the training was unbelievable for it. And so I should clarify a bit. So I did it, the first time I attempted this was November 2018. And on day 22 of that expedition, it was the worst weather in like 50 years, which I found out when I got home, which was like, of course it was. So the weather was absolutely atrocious, like complete whiteouts, and it just never lifted. And it was really hard to navigate in. It's really tiring to navigate in because you cannot take your eye off the compass. And also, like for me, it brought on a lot of nausea and vomiting because there's no kind of horizon for the eyes to settle on. So it's really bizarre. That was fine. I'm going to carry on. There was a huge amount of snow. There normally isn't in Antarctica. There's very low levels of precipitation. So there's not, everything is designed to kind of almost more like to be on a glacier type environment with a tiny amount of snow. And all of a sudden, the snow was thigh deep in places.
Wow.
So I was like, wow, this is harder than I thought it was going to be. But still, keep going. Like, you've worked so hard to get here. And I got sick on day 22, so just under halfway. And I had a bowel infection, quite a dangerous one. And I knew I was sick. I knew it wasn't just like a bit of a headache, you know, I need something to, it'll go away soon. So I think I had a day where I stayed in the tent, and then the medical team back at base camp, who speak to you by satellite phone, were getting pretty concerned. And 2 years prior, a British polar explorer had passed away from peritonitis, which is a bowel infection. And so they were especially, understandably, on edge. I wanted me out of there pronto. And it's very, very difficult to accept that the expedition could be over, because you have this fear, number one, what if it's nothing? What if I get back to base camp and I'm totally fine? Like, imagine telling people that back home. And there'd been a huge amount of press interest before I went on this, you know, world record attempt. So you're thinking about that, thinking about all the people that have helped you get there. And I didn't want this to end. but I knew I was sick. And so on the kind of the second day of being in the tent, they forced a medevac on me. A lot of people, like the people who've listened to the phone calls on the satellite phone, because they record them, said it was like the most polite British argument ever between me and the doctor. Like, no, I really don't think I need to be medevaced, okay? At that time, actually, the theory that they were working on was that I might have appendicitis, something like that, not a bowel infection. You couldn't know that already. No one had examined me. I do remember the plane landed right beside me, which was just bizarre because I hadn't seen anyone for that long period of time. I remember them examining me. I remember the doctor testing to see if I was pregnant. And I remember saying to him, if I'm pregnant, like, watch as I lose my shit in Antarctica. And he was like, oh, maybe we shouldn't do a test. I'm not sure. But yeah, I got back to base camp and then was flown. I went downhill at base camp in quite a big way. But they pumped me full of antibiotics. And then the huge kind of jet plane that lands in Antarctica was brought forward by half a day to come and get me and other tourists, and went back to Chile, and from there and was stabilized in hospital, I think for 2 or 3 days, and then flown back to London. And once I was in London, I mean, I felt almost completely better, but yeah, they confirmed it was peritonitis. And I think I was home about a week later. I knew immediately that I was going back. I didn't enjoy the feeling of failure at all. And I think it's because it was so public. And I remember being in hospital and I had my phone on airplane mode. I didn't want to deal with anyone just yet. I thought the newspaper would be safe. And I opened up the Metro, and the second page was a huge picture of me looking really sad in polar explorer gear. I've got no idea where they got the photo from. And the headline was like, London lawyer fails at world record attempt. And I was like, ah, I hate you all.
Yeah.
got rid of the Metro. But I was down for about 3 days. And then it, you know, 3 days of like, I'm watching Netflix, I'm hanging out with the dog, I don't want to speak to anyone. And then it was like, right, plan of action. Yeah, back on it. Tell everyone at work. Tell, like, because everyone wanted to speak to me. Understandably. Like, what happened? What went wrong? Are you okay? So yeah, spoke to my husband, Matt, he'd been to Antarctica with me. So I can't believe I forgot to say this. Sorry. I did climb Mount Vinson first before I did the world record attempt. Part of it was I wanted to acclimatize. It's quite kind of high altitude down there, higher than you might think. And also wanted to climb Mount Vinson. So Matt and I did that as our honeymoon. And then he flew home and then I was flown to the coastline to start the actual world record attempt after a few days rest. So it was very, very cool that we got to do that together. But yeah, then coming back to London, I'd failed it. I wanted to do it again. The problems I had was I had promised the board at work. At this point, I was head of legal at a renewable energy company. I'd promised them that Antarctica would be my last kind of major expedition where I needed, you know, 6 to 8 weeks off. And after that, I'll properly behave and everything I do will be in like normal annual leave. And I could tell as soon as I got back, they really wanted to know, are you going to go back? So I was just dodging. And also, I don't think I wanted the decision to go back to be totally linked to having failed, like separate the two things. Does it really mean that much to you to go and do this? Because, you know, it's basically finding another $100,000. I had no idea what my sponsors would think. Like, are you having a laugh? We just funded that. We're not doing that again. So I just kept it very much to myself. And it's very much for me a joint decision between my husband and I, because it's a huge ask of the partner in your life to go through this with you. Like for the 2 years before the first attempt, Antarctica is your life every day. If you're not working, you're doing some kind of admin or pitching to a sponsor or doing something, training. Our weekends were all about my training. Like, let's go to the Lake District this weekend. I'd get up at 5 and start dragging tires, and then Matt would kind of sleep in and come meet me halfway or whatever. So I think it's a big ask on the other person. And he didn't think it was a big deal. He just said, yes, so fine. I think I just worried a bit too much about the impact it would have on him. But decided to go back again. I was so fortunate that when I phoned my sponsors to basically ask them or test the waters what they thought, I was so nervous about speaking to the sponsors, and I like had this little script written out and was really anxious about the call. And they're like, Jen, we've been wondering when you're going to ask. Like, huge relief. So they had my back immediately. A lot of people thought it was a bit much to kind of go back that same year. So to explain, the window in Antarctica to go and do something like this is in Antarctic summer, which runs from November to January. So I got back from the bowel infection early January, and then wanted to go back that November to do it again. I had to tell work, and actually I kind of got accidentally busted by my boss. Thought he thinks I mentioned it in a blog, which I don't remember doing.
Oh, really?
And kind of had a chat with me about what I'd said in the blog or an interview or something. And I was like, oh dear, which interview was that? it was fine. I went back. I trained. I got some, actually a different coaching team, trained even harder than I couldn't think my training could have been different. And actually with these new coaches, I was like, my God, they're really taking this up a notch. It was a hard year fitting it all in with work, because it was such an ask to let me go back that you don't want to let anyone down. You don't want to disappoint the people that you work with, because you're never going to be allowed to do it again. And also I'd given them my word that I wouldn't be doing it again. And here I am doing it again. This time it was amazing. The weather was what it's supposed to be in Antarctica. And everything just came together. I was absolutely flying. I felt invincible. And I was 2 days ahead of the world record, which is huge. I was so happy. And I think it was about 100 miles from the end, roughly. I started to develop this condition on my leg called polar thigh. And it's a type of severe chilblain. It's the best way of describing it. It's not frostbite. It's like a non-freezing cold injury. Women are more prone to getting it than men. And I got it pretty severely on my inner thigh. And it starts off as these small little ulcers that break up. So I was covering them up with whatever, you know, little bit of Granuflex dressing I had. I'd cut out exactly what I needed and planted on. And you don't have a limitless supply of, you know, first aid stuff, because you're dragging a sled with everything you need behind it. And I'm going for the speed record. So I'm very lightweight with everything that I have. So I had one little sheet of dressing because of course, like, it's me, I'm not going to have an injury, what a load of nonsense. So I don't need 4 or 5 sheets, I'll just take one, thanks. So I was really having to cut up just exactly what I needed to cover the open wound. And then one day in a whiteout, I had a really pathetic fall, like a nothing fall, but the entire leg split open and I heard the crack, I heard the split, and it became one long open wound on my inner thigh. And then I also had a tiny bit on my inner arm and some spots on the back of my leg, really small spots. And it's very, very hard to describe the pain from that. I've never felt anything like it. And I had some painkillers that were pretty strong, but they were meant for the scenario that I fell down a crevasse and had to phone for a rescue and just to be comfortable, assuming I'd, you know, really injured myself. They're not designed for you to take two and then ski for 16 hours a day with. and you can't take pain relief while you, because you're solo. If I'd been in a team, it might have been different. You know, someone would have taken the lead on navigation or whatever, and I would have just been doped up at the back on pain relief. You can't do that in a solo environment. It's far too dangerous. You need to have your wits about you. You're navigating. You're doing everything. So I would use them at nighttime to help me sleep. But the pain at nighttime was almost worse than the day, because I think the body was trying. And I now know it's called a reperfusion injury. And so it keeps worsening as actually the blood flow comes back to the area. So the pain I was experiencing, I thought my leg was getting better at nighttime. It wasn't. But the pain of that blood trying to get back to the area was just agonizing. And I would sleep with, I couldn't sleep, I always sleep on my side, but I couldn't sleep with my legs touching. So I had to wedge all my socks in between my legs to kind of keep a gap so the wound wasn't touching anything. A lot of people ask how I did it. And there's no way I was not reaching the South Pole again.
Yeah.
Also, I was so close. The same doctors, who I'm now very good friends with, did want me to pull the plug. They're like, you know, look, you've done amazing. Just, you know, this is going to get worse. It's not getting better in the field. And I turned that down many times because, and some people think that was a bit daft, but just to kind of give context, I wasn't sick. I didn't have a fever. I didn't feel unwell. I also didn't believe the injury was that bad. So what I could see seeping out of the wound looked like scab to me. And I was like, look, the scab, it's getting better. Scab is good. And it wasn't scab. It was, you know, dried blood and all sorts of ugh in there. I've always known I've had the ability to push through difficult things. That's how you, you know, run across deserts. It's not always easy. But what spooked me when I got home, not at the time because it wasn't processed then, but once I got home, was the ability to push through that was scary to me. It's like, this isn't necessarily a good thing.
Yeah, and I've seen the pictures on, and people should follow you on social media, and you posted them not so long ago on Instagram, and I mean they're insane. It's I don't know how you pushed through that. It is remarkable that you did. But how did it feel getting to the South Pole? What was that moment like?
Honestly, it was a bit of an anticlimax. All I remember about arriving is, there's a scientific station owned by the Americans at the South Pole, and they're very, very proud of it. And the Brits, that like the bit that we're allowed to go into, is very far away from them, and it's very small. And you're told right at the beginning of anything you do in Antarctica, don't go into their patch. You know, like we get bollocked if you go into their patch. It really damages international relations. And I don't know what kind of mindset I was in, but I was so worried about causing some kind of, fallout. And I was being so careful about navigating this last kind of couple hundred meters. But I got there, and there is a very small camp. I think there's about 6 tents, you know, that someone like me, I guess a tourist ultimately, can go and hang out in. And Dev is an amazing guy who works at ALE, the kind of logistics company out there. And he was there, he flings open the door and he's like, Jan, you're here. And I just collapsed into his arms. Him and another guide, Cedar, we just drank beers until about 3 or 4 in the morning. I arrived, I think I arrived at like 11 p.m. And I remember the first thing them noticing is they couldn't believe the smell coming from my leg. And I remember being like, what are you talking about? It doesn't smell of anything. And my leg was necrotic. So you can see that in one of the photos. There's a huge black patch in the middle. And that's death. That's the skin. She was dyed. And no one, all the doctors, they cannot believe that I couldn't smell it. And when I got to the North Pole, I have not been to the North Pole, to be clear. I was put on a lot of drugs. They basically wanted to keep me comfortable, safe. And the doctor said to me, I want you to just sip beer, take all the morphine. We're not taking the dressing off your leg here because there's no shower facilities and we need to keep this clean or I'll get infected in a heartbeat. And we can't fly out to the main base camp where there are showers for another 3 to 4 days because of weather. So my experience of the South Pole is being totally high as a kite. I drank beer and was on loads of drugs and had a great time.
Were you able to chat to Matt during that time? He must have been pretty worried about you.
No, I didn't call home. I'm not great at doing stuff like that. Satellite minutes are really expensive. I have something called an InReach, which allows you to send almost like really short text messages. So I was doing a bit of that. I remember a lot of people, there was some other people there who'd finished expeditions or were halfway through them or whatever, and they were filming everything and photographing everything. I'm really terrible at that. I can't be bothered most of the time. But you do regret it once you're home, so you shouldn't be like me. I had a great time. And then we flew back to base camp, which I think was like a 5-hour flight, 5-6 hour, really long flight. I find that really difficult. It was a lot of pain. There was a medic on that flight, and he just kept giving me more and more painkillers. As soon as we landed, I was taken to the shower block. And honestly, the shower block experience was probably the most traumatic thing that's ever happened to me, which I don't know if that sounds melodramatic, but I'm really not being melodramatic. It's the hardest thing I've ever gone through pain-wise, because the dressing I mentioned that I'd kind of patched on, and you can see one of the photos, it looks like a horrible patchwork quilt. You can't quite figure out what you're looking at, because I'd applied it myself, that had to come off in the shower. And so it had to be pre-soaked. You can't just, also it's attached to raw skin. So I think I was in there for about 40 minutes and then had to peel it off myself. I remember the doctor passing me a bottle of whiskey. So like where the shower gel normally goes in the shower was a bottle of whiskey. And he was feeding me, I can't remember the name of the painkiller, but you put it under your tongue, a really strong one, through the shower curtain. And I just remember holding onto the sides, and like people tell me I sounded like a wounded animal. Got through that. And then from there was flown back to the UK. British Airways took amazing care of me. And then I landed at Heathrow. Matt met me, and I had to be in a wheelchair. I couldn't walk very easily at all. Matt is a plastic surgeon in the NHS. And so for this kind of injury, he'd be the guy that would operate on you in the UK. And he didn't want to operate on his wife, funnily enough. But I remember at the airport, he was like, we've got to go to the Royal Free. The whole team's waiting, like we're ready to operate. And I had no idea that I would need surgery.
Really?
Yeah. I was like, Matt, stop being such a drama queen. Like, what are you talking about? I know it needs to be looked at. I know it probably needs a good wash. It needs to be bandaged up. But I really just thought this was like a massive scab. Because bear in mind, so I didn't want to look at it when they took the bandage off in Antarctica. I didn't want to see it. I wasn't interested. So it was all being covered up. I got to the hospital and I knew all the team because they're Matt's friends. So I was like, well, hi guys. We're gonna do the operation now. You need me to clear out all that dead tissue in the first operation, and then we'll see what's what. And I remember thinking, like, this is so weird. And I kept saying, like, but I haven't seen the dog. Like, I need to go home. I haven't been home in so long. I want my pajamas. Like, why don't I come to hospital? I had two operations. First one was a big clean out. Second one was a skin graft. And when I was in hospital, Matt's boss did the surgery in the end, and he is an amazing doctor, Dr. Woolard, Alex Woolard, and he noticed that something wasn't quite right with me mentally, and he called in the psychologist. And it's the best thing he could have done, because I remember thinking, like, I don't need to speak to a psychologist, but I was definitely experiencing like mild PTSD,
right?
Of the shower experience, like that was coming back to haunt me all the time. But then also when I was in hospital, the entire ward kept turning into a huge storm in Antarctica. And so, and every time it was a slightly different scenario of, but basically the premise was someone was preventing me getting to the pole. So I could see the South Pole just behind me, and it would be like Father Christmas would appear and say, no, South Pole's actually shut. You're going to have to go back the way you came. Or I'm really sorry, you're at the wrong pole. Go the other way around, planet Earth. All these different things. And it was weird. And I saw the psychologist twice, and she also kind of talked me through that the determination to reach the pole, to get there, meant that I allowed my brain to block out the smell of the rotting flesh. Wow. And there's no way that didn't smell.
Yeah.
It was black. I promise you, absolutely promise you, I couldn't smell a thing. And when people at the pole first commented how bad it smelled, I properly put my nose into it. And everyone was like, oh, Jed, what are you doing? That is gross. And I just couldn't smell anything. And she was like, that was your mental strength saying, we're going to the pole. And that's also why I thought it was healing. If you look at the photos, there's no way you think that's healing.
Yeah.
I'm not lying. Like, that is really what I thought. So it wasn't that I was telling myself, you've got to keep going. It was like, no, like, of course I'm going to keep going. And there's nothing that wrong with me. Now, it's very mild PTSD. I had those flashbacks for maybe 2 or 3 weeks, and I really struggled to get into a shower. That would really bring it back immediately, yeah. So, like, Matt was amazing. He was super patient with me, and I hated water touching the wound. I didn't look at the wounds for maybe 8 weeks. But the psychologist was amazing, and it was really interesting to understand that it was like the power of the brain. And I think that's why I got freaked out. I said earlier, I was freaked out when I got home, because I don't think it's, and the psychologist said to me this too, it's not great that you can do that.
Right.
It's great. Of course, with everything, there's a balance. She had me read this book called The Body Keeps the Score, which is a great book about similar things to this. And, I think what I got from it was, like, I should really respect my body a bit more. And would I maybe push to that extent again? I'd like to say no, but I don't know if that's really true. and also for me now, you know, the whole thing's recovered. It's one hell of a scar. It's a massive scar. Skin grafts mostly don't take, and I think like 60% of it took, which is a good result. I think it looks like the outline of the coastline of Antarctica in one bit. No one else thinks that, but I do. And I just don't mind. When people see the scar, they're pretty horrified, if I'm honest. But I am just so over the moon that I made it.
Yeah.
And it's also nice to not have a desire to do it again.
It's a really... breathtaking is the best word I can think of. You know, it takes my breath away just hearing you talk about it, and it such an amazing experience, and just blows my mind that you were able to, you know, have the power over your mind to get through that. Do you have full mobility now? Are you okay? Yeah. Now moving around, everything's fine.
The kind of, this would be a very different conversation if I'd caused damage to function of my leg.
Yeah.
I would be absolutely heartbroken, and I'd probably be mortified that I carried on just for the sake of arriving at the pole. But it's just tissue damage, if you like, quite deep in some places, but there's no damage to the muscle or function, which I'm very grateful for.
And what about like adventure going forward? Because you've obviously all your life, you've done these things, like you pushed yourself and you've put yourself in to these conditions where you're facing adversity. That's obviously a part of who you are, right?
Mm-hmm.
I'm not necessarily asking you if you're ever going to go to the South Pole again, but Are there things on the horizon that you want to do, or do you have a slightly different attitude and approach to that now?
Oh, no, I want to do even more. I was supposed to be rowing the Pacific in 2 months' time with a group of girls, but I'm nearly 8.5 months pregnant. So that had to be cancelled.
Wow. Well, congratulations.
Thanks. It was really funny. I signed up to be part of the team and found out I was pregnant the next day, which was like, oh dear, what's happened here? There's definitely things I want to do. But things like that might have to take a bit of a back burner for a couple of years. The very long expeditions, maybe not for another year or two. Up next is the Adventure Race World Championships in Paraguay. There's never been an all-female team take part at the world championship level. So adventure racing is it's basically a bit of every kind of extreme sport in one kind of 7 or 8 day long race. You don't always know what the sports will be, how long you'll be kayaking for versus mountain biking for. So we'll be four women taking part, which has never happened before. But unfortunately, that means we do not qualify to appear in the rankings of the race, because you must have one male, one female in every team. So we're working on kind of changing that and at least having different team rankings. So there's, you know, an all-male one, an all-female one, and then mixed, because it's not done that way at the moment. But that'll be really exciting. I'm looking forward to that. That's early kind of next year. So a bit of time to figure out what to do with a newborn.
Yeah.
Training, I guess. Yeah.
You got the adventure of parenthood in between, right? To go with, which is awesome. Now, I love that you're doing the Adventure Race World Champs. I didn't realize that was something you were looking at. That's awesome. I love adventure racing. I could just literally talk to you for hours on end. This has been just wild. And I you know, the photos of your leg, I definitely, people should look at it. If they're not squeamish, they should look at it. If they are squeamish, yeah, maybe not. But
yeah,
it is a wonderful achievement. And you made it all the way to the South Pole, which is just it's just unbelievable. So just to bring things to a close and give you back your evening, I 28 Summers is all about living adventurously. And you know, of course, you know, going to the South Pole or rowing an ocean or climbing a mountain are all like the pinnacle of you know, adventure and exploration. But for, I think for a lot of people, living adventurously, I just mean about mindset. I'm just talking about people maybe being open to doing things that are pushing their boundaries a little bit and helping them just be a bit more adventurous in their day-to-day lives. And a lot of people that are listening will have been really inspired by your story. And I was curious to know what your advice for them may be for anybody looking to live more adventurously.
Yeah, I think the one thing I get a lot when people hear about, specifically about Antarctica, is, oh my God, I could never do that. And I'm always like, it's just not true. There's just nothing special about me at all. And it's more a case of, I get you might not want to do a solo ski to the South Pole. That's totally normal. But if you're applying that I can't do that mindset to this, the story that you've heard about Antarctica, someone else doing it, you're probably doing it in other areas of your life. And you know, you don't have to do something like Antarctica. That's completely whack and out there. I get that. And it's years of focus and dedication, and most people don't want to have time for that. But I do think the way a lot of these expeditions are reported on in the press, or how people might talk about them, makes them seem inaccessible. It's kind of like, I've done this amazing thing. You never could, but listen to my story anyway. It's super inspiring. And it's just not true. Like, Antarctica might sound like this huge elephant, but you know, we all know this, you kind of break it down. And it's not that big a deal. So I'd say a lot of people say they want to do something like Antarctica. And I'm like, cool, like, just start, break it down. What do I need to learn? How long do I need to learn it? What's a reasonable time frame for me to get from A to the start line, and break it down and just go for it and see what happens? But I think if you want to get the benefits from a major expedition like that, which for me are things like resilience, grit, skiing with open wounds, you don't need to do anything like that. Like, for me, you get that same experience from going like wild camping for a week in Scotland and maybe, you know, giving yourself like destination A, I'm going to get to B. I've got a map. I'm going to navigate myself there. I'm going to sleep in bothies as I go, or I'm going to camp. Or a running holiday, you know, around the Lake District where you're camping as you go. You get all the same lessons from being somewhere as wild and remote and expensive as Antarctica for much cheaper, and you can fit it in around your kind of day-to-day life. Like I'll often will disappear for a long weekend up to the Scottish Islands and do something like that. It just costs nothing. So yeah, I would say don't, if you want to do something extreme, don't be intimidated by the way a lot of these expeditions are reported on. They're not that difficult to put together. They just take, oh my God, just like don't give up because you get knockbacks every day, all day. But if you're like, no, that's not for me, I could never do that. That's not true. There's definitely other things, smaller adventures you could do locally that will give you, I think, what you're looking for.
I love that answer. I think that's really, really good advice. And I think you're right. I think sometimes these big epic expeditions and adventures are deliberately positioned to be kind of unattainable for people. But
yeah, very, very kind of exclusive.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So I completely agree. And I also love that notion that you can also get a ton of value just from doing stuff close to home or within your local country, and that those things can be really meaningful and definitely the barriers are much lower. I think that's great advice. Where can people follow you online? Where can they find you?
Definitely just on Instagram, jenny.wordsworth, because I never update my website.
Great stuff. All right. Well, we'll make sure we signpost people there. And best of luck to you and Matt with the baby. That's really exciting.
Thanks very much. I'm very excited.
It's been an absolute pleasure to talk to you tonight and just hear your story. Totally breathtaking. Thank you so much for sharing it. Such a fascinating insight into the mind of an ultra endurance athlete. Jenny is so down to earth and really humble despite her incredible accomplishments, and it really blows my mind what she was able to endure just to make it to the end of that challenge. It's a truly remarkable story from start to finish. Please be sure to follow Jenny on Instagram at jenny.wordsworth, and of course let us know what you think of this interview and the entire 28 Summers podcast. Thank you as always for listening. It really means the world to me. That's it from me today. I will be back soon with another awesome guest. In the meantime, stay happy, stay healthy, and remember to live adventurously.